material, and Spain providing all sorts of things, money and supplies for the rebellion in what would soon be the United States of America. The war was actually not going badly at this time, thanks to Spanish help. And, well, all over the world, in the Caribbean, of course, the Spaniards are trying to take back Florida at this point. And, well, the French are making problems in India. The Portuguese are making problems in Brazil. And the, well, there are all sorts of things. The British can't be everywhere at once. And Britain itself is only lightly defended. And so, the idea, this is 1779, the Great Armada of 1779. This is a joint Spanish-French operation to invade England. First, the Isle of Wight, and then the mainland, right? Terra firme. The mainland in England, a southern port. That is not Spain's principal objective. Spain's principal objective is to retake Gibraltar, which had fallen earlier. Gibraltar and Menorca. Menorca at that point was British. Gibraltar was British, and Spain wanted them both back. So as we will see, there will be a concentration of forces in Gibraltar, but why not take advantage of the fact that Britain is practically undefended? There, in the English Channel, right, El Canal de la Mancha, you only have about 35 ships of the line, right? 35 warships available under the direction of Sir Charles Hardy. Now, Sir Charles Hardy had been a hero. He had been there at the taking of Canada, right? Going up the St. Lawrence River and providing support for General Wolfe. I'll be talking about when Britain acquired Canada. I'll be talking about that on another program. But he was there. He was there at that time. But Hardy had not seen action for the previous 20 years. Harvey was 64 years old then. And, let's imagine that Britain was undefended. Now, the fact is that the Americans were very interested in the outcome of this invasion as well. So you had a divisionary fleet under the command of John Paul Jones, the great American naval hero. I'll speak about him on my next program, but he was taking his flagship, Buque Insignia, and it was the Bonhomme Richard, named after the most famous book by Benjamin Franklin, Poor Richard's Almanac. The French version of Poor Richard's Almanac was called Bonhomme Richard. And so, yeah, Bonhomme Richard was going to be the name of his flagship. And he was on a divisionary trip. He was going to attack one of the ports of Britain, right, in England, Whitehaven, so that, and he did. He attacked Whitehaven. It caused a panic all throughout Britain. But at the same time, now, There was an army of 40,000 men gathering in Saint-Malo and Le Havre in France, getting ready to board the French and Spanish ships and invade England. Now, things began to go wrong. The French, commanded by Admiral Dorvilliers, they started out, they arrived at the rendezvous point where they were supposed to meet the Spanish. Now, this was just off La Coruña. And the Spanish didn't arrive, and the Spanish didn't arrive, didn't arrive, didn't arrive. The French had left their harbor, their port, in Brest, in France. They had left with very few provisions in order not to alert suspicion, right? There were spies everywhere, and so they wanted to do this surreptitiously. So, yes, they left the port without enough food, without enough supplies, and they arrived at the meeting point at the correct time, and then they had to wait and wait and wait, and the Spanish didn't show up, and wait. Finally, the Spanish appeared under Don Luis de Córdoba, an admiral that we're going to see. If anyone has a responsibility in the Spanish failure at this time, it's going to be Don Luis de Córdoba. He did everything wrong. At the same time, he was rewarded. He was praised. He was treated, and his reputation is still intact. This is something I cannot explain. I do not understand, because if there is a bad guy wearing a black hat in this story, if there is anybody who did damage to Spain and to Spain's reputation at this time, it is going to be Don Luis de Córdoba. So, either through miscommunication, bad luck, later on, the excuse was that the wind was not favorable. Or it could be pure incompetence. Because as we will see, Don Luis is incompetent. In any case, it didn't happen. The rendezvous was late. The French began to succumb to the problems of so many people living on the same ship, right? Such conditions of hacinamiento, of crowding, dysentery and so forth. Remember that our idea of hygiene, higiene, it didn't exist back then. And so conditions on board ship were not healthy. It was just... It was inevitable, and the French had been waiting and waiting and waiting, and the diseases that they had very soon passed to the Spanish ships as well. Something had to be done. Something had to be done at that point. What the Spanish and French did not know is that the English defenders, Hardy, had gone out into the Atlantic, and they were looking in the wrong place. In fact, the channel was practically entirely undefended. So any invasion at that time would have been successful. Dorvilliers received orders from Paris that he was to proceed to Cornwall. Imagine sort of that the British Isles are a kind of a pyramid, right? Maybe an unbalanced pyramid, but a pyramid, and the bottom is flat. Well, you would go to the east. You would go to the right side of that pyramid if you were looking at a map, and Cornwall is over on that side. Cornwall is very remote. Cornwall, at this time, still speaking Celtic.
right? The local people among themselves would still speak one of the Celtic languages, Celta. Well, Cornwall, that couldn't be right. And Dauvilliers decided that this was stupid. Instead of taking the initiative and disobeying orders, he asked for clarification. And this was a very, very bad idea, because it meant more waiting and more waiting. Even better for the French at this time, the British flagship, right, the one carrying the admiral, the one carrying Hardy, it was called the Ardent, right, as if it were burning. Ardent. Ardent, a synonym for passionate. Well, the Ardent was captured by the French, using the oldest trick in the book. The French were flying British colors, and the Ardent believed that the French ships were British. And so they treated them as friends rather than enemies, and fell into the trap. So that, yes, Hardy is taken captive, the British flagship is taken captive, and there is absolutely no defense possible. England could not be more vulnerable at this point. Now, the French and Spanish allies are just off the coast of Plymouth. It just occurs to me, earlier when I was talking about Cornwall, I said it was on the right. I said it was toward the east. It isn't. It's on the left. It's toward the west. All right. It's the far west. Okay. Plymouth. Plymouth is much closer to London. It's much closer to the heart of things. It's a much bigger and more desirable port. Better defended, obviously. But again, what a prize if the French and the Spanish can take the city of Plymouth and destroy the shipyards there, right? That would have been that would have made an enormous difference in the war effort. They were doing nothing. They were waiting for the orders, the clarification of the orders to arrive from France, and so nothing happened. They got more and more, hungrier and hungrier, sicker and sicker, and finally, as happens at that time of year, there was a summer storm, and they were blown out of the channel all the way into the Atlantic Ocean. Meanwhile, the British fleet had come back from the Atlantic. They were in the Solent Firth. Solent Firth, something that separates Scotland from England. I'm going to talk about that on my next program when I talk about John Paul Jones, the great American naval hero, right? Number one, the founder of the American Navy. John Paul Jones was actually Scottish, and he was from the Solent Firth. So, well, now, and at that point, he was attacking the Solent Firth. So it made a lot of sense for the fleet to arrive there. Toward the end of August, word still hadn't arrived. They didn't know what to do. If they waited any longer, the disease would devastate them, and there wouldn't be anybody left to fight. They gave up. They went home. The invasion was canceled. But it's a very, very interesting what if. In any case, they didn't want to fight in the autumn or the winter. So they simply went home. Now, for the French, this was a disaster because It was so expensive. So many people had been kept on hold, right? Waiting for so long. But there was also what economists call an opportunity cost. An opportunity cost is every time you make a choice to do one thing with your resources, with your assets, every time you choose to do one thing, you are also choosing not to do something else. And in this case, by putting all the men, the time, the energy into the invasion of England, Spain had diverted all of these resources into what should have been the main objective, what everybody knew was the main objective, the recovery of Gibraltar. So that the initial attack on Gibraltar was light. And so that gave the people in Gibraltar a time that they needed to build up their defenses. They understood what was coming. And they understood that this was going to be a major siege. And consequently, right, the element of surprise completely disappeared. All because of this failed invasion. As I say, the attack by John Paul Jones, that attack succeeded. And that attack caused a panic throughout Britain. And throughout Britain and throughout the empire, so that it was decided that the maritime defenses were going to have to be strengthened. And this began. This meant that in the future, it was going to be much, much more difficult, right? Napoleon, just a generation later, Napoleon contemplates an invasion of Britain. But Britain at that point is going to defend itself quite well. I mean, in the 19th century, in 1801, they start the construction of all kinds of towers in, well, Mallorca, in Ireland, in the Caribbean, and of course, all through Britain, the Martello Towers. If you've been on the coast in Britain, it is quite possible that you have seen Martello Towers. They are formidable and very, very good defense. There are still, what, more than 140 of them. And but the prototype of the Martello Towers was being constructed in response to this threat of invasion, because it could have happened. As I say, what if it had happened? Britain was absolutely vulnerable at that point. So all this money, all this time, all this energy for nothing. And naturally, the commander-in-chief, d'Orvilliers, resigned. He resigned in humiliation. Now, what happened to Don Luis de Cordoba? He did not resign. No. He was promoted. And again, at that point, he was very, very old. Far too old. Right? We're going to see him practically as the person responsible for the fact that Gibraltar was not taken. And what happens after that? He becomes the head of the Spanish Navy. They put him in charge of the Spanish Navy after what he had done. In any case, all right. This is how it begins. The siege, the Great Siege of Gibraltar, defended by George Augustus Elliot. They began with a blockade. And as I say, this killed the element of surprise. Initially, this was done exclusively by the Spanish. Later on, the French were going to go and help. Under the Spanish, it was Martín Álvarez de Sotomayor who was responsible for this. This was followed up by a maritime blockade. And it was Antonio Barceló who was responsible for that. Now, Barceló had been a privateer, right? Una especie de pirata. He had been a pirate. He had a letter of marque, which meant that he was working with the authorization of his government. But still, what he was trying to do was, a pirate trying to eliminate piracy. He was working against the Algerians, right? Algerian War was being fought at this time. Spain and Algeria were at war at this time. And Barceló had distinguished himself in that. And as a combination pirate fighter, we can put it that way. And he was now in charge of the marine forces and the maritime forces blockading the bay. Sotomayor was a grande de España. He had been, essential in taking parts of Italy. Remember that during the 18th century, the great Spanish objective, actually no, the great Bourbon objective, because the Bourbon monarchy at that time was actually working kind of against Spain's best interests. They were working for their own interests and pouring a lot of resources into Italy. Sotomayor had seen extensive battle in Italy. And then in times of peace, remember that under Fernando VI, they declared peace, and Fernando VI is the one that built Spain back up after so much war. During that time, he had been in Austria and in Russia as a military attaché, right? Un agregado. Extensive experience, right? Very few people as cosmopolitan as Sotomayor. Then, of course, when Carlos III became king, it was time for war again. Fernando VI had built up the treasury, and so there was plenty of money. And Carlos III spent that money on a world-class navy. That was the priority. And also invading Portugal, right? There was the invasion of Portugal. Sotomayor was also part of that. Later on, by the way, in the times of the French Revolution, Sotomayor is so valued that he is going to be the viceroy of Navarra. You can imagine, during the French Revolution, everything was chaotic and violent, and that violence had a real potential for crossing the border, right? And so you would need a person of trust on the border. So Sotomayor was the person, the viceroy of Navarra. And Sotomayor and Barceló were in charge, but everything was ineffective until the French came in and Crillon took over. Sotomayor was demoted. This was now a French operation. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute.
Si los profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan. Un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello, tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911-335831. 911-335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Hey, have you heard about our trimestrales? No? Well, let me tell you all about them. The program lasts 3 months. Eso es, dura 3 meses. Many different timetables to choose from. From Monday to Friday, Saturdays in the morning. And you'll have plenty of homework. And your teacher will correct your homework and check it to make sure you're making progress. Find out more now. Our trimestrales at Vaughan. Small groups, only 4 to 6 students per class, and the class is focused on speaking and using the language. Contact us and find out about trimestrales with one of our dynamic Vaughan teachers. You won't regret it. No te arrepentirás. More information at grupovaughan.com.
Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa, pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughan Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832. Tú tienes una necesidad real de aprender inglés. Tú buscas los mejores resultados. Lo que para muchos parecía una quimera es ahora una realidad constatable. Llámanos al 911-333-5833. 911-333-5833. En Vaughan llevamos más de 40 años con la pasión de formar a los empleados, directivos, a ti. Llevamos el método Vaughan a tu empresa a través de uno de nuestros profesores certificados Vaughan, con clases dinámicas e intensas, con horarios 100% flexibles. O clases de inglés telefónicas para empresas. Su formato mixto entre conversación fluida y corrección con el método Vaughan mejorará radicalmente el inglés de tus empleados con los horarios más complicados. Inmersiones lingüísticas totales en las que tus empleados, alejados de los problemas de la vida real, se centrarán exclusivamente en hablar en inglés durante
durante todo el día en nuestro Vaughan Town para empresas. O una nueva solución para aquellos colectivos que necesitan flexibilidad con respecto a la ubicación de los alumnos, a la vez que necesitan contacto regular con un profesor. Nuestras clases por videoconferencia para empresas. Y no olvides el máster para ejecutivos en el programa más exigente de Vaughan. Infórmate en grupovaughan.com o llamando al 911335831. 911335831. Grupo Vaughan. Más de 40 años encontrando soluciones. In Company.
Hemos escuchado el movimiento número 12 de John Tunes. Esta tarde tendrá lugar en el Auditorio Nacional una sinfonía del compositor Richard Higgins.
No te líes, lo mejorcito para aprender inglés lo tienes en Vaughan. Tenemos una amplia variedad de cursos para todos los niveles, todos los horarios, todas las edades y todos los bolsillos. 911335833 o grupovaughan.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was talking about the major attempt, the focus, the real purpose of all of the problems that Spain was trying to cause the British Empire in the 1770s. One minor product of this was the creation of the United States. But that was not the center. That was not the objective. Spain retook Florida. But that was not the center. There were problems. Yeah, all sorts of places all over the world, the Caribbean. And meanwhile, the French were also making problems in Canada and, well, in India. But the center, the true objective, was first a naval invasion, an amphibious invasion of England. And as we saw, that didn't work. The Great Armada of 1779 didn't work. But at the same time, we're talking about the retaking of Gibraltar. And the retaking of Gibraltar was the center stage. So there were more British troops involved in Gibraltar than were involved in the War of Independence of the 13 colonies. All eyes are on Gibraltar. Pretty soon, for example, the United States will exist. Pretty soon, the British will leave, thanks to Spanish help and French help and the presence of the French Navy. The British simply surrender. And America and Britain are ready to sign the peace treaty. But that peace treaty can't be signed because of the French, because of the Spanish, because the question of Gibraltar is still pending. So here they are in Paris, the American representatives, the Conde de Aranda from Spain, waiting for news from Gibraltar. And Gibraltar is under siege. Now, in 1779, in winter, the provisions became very scarce. Only the sick, the very sick, and children were allowed to eat bread. The food you would normally get would be preserved meat, usually salted meat, and hard biscuits. I've forgotten the name of those biscuits. The biscuits that you would eat on a ship, right? It's kind of very, very difficult to eat, very difficult to chew, especially if your teeth are in bad conditions, because escorbuto, scurvy, attacks the teeth first, right? Then you would need water or something like that to make it softer in order to be able to ingest this. Now I have forgotten the name in Spanish. In any case, that was what people had to live on. There were no fires. In order to build a fire, you would need wood. There was no wood. So people were going out into the harbor and cannibalizing the ships in the harbor to be able to use that wood for fires. Help was coming. December 1779, under Admiral George Rodney, they were traveling, and on the way next to Finisterre, they found a Spanish fleet. And they were able to capture many of the Spanish ships. And so the British ships with provisions were joined by Spanish ships with provisions. Now, would they be able to break the blockade? Would they be able to enter into Algeciras Harbor and relieve the garrison at Gibraltar? Yes, they penetrated the blockade with no problem whatsoever, bringing an extra 1,000 men from the Highland Regiment and all kinds of supplies. And so Gibraltar now really had none of the problems it had previously. They were able to hold out until the following winter. This would be the winter of 1780-1781. The second winter, it was the same thing. A disease, a starvation, scurvy, escorbuto. Civilians and military personnel on very reduced rations. And the Spanish blockade was very effective against, for example, the Portuguese. The Portuguese were coming with fresh fruit and vegetables, and very few of them were able to penetrate the blockade. In April of 1781, a second provision fleet, 29 ships escorting 100 ships filled with provisions directly from England, entered the bay with no problem whatsoever. The Spanish, from their fortresses, right, outside Gibraltar, they tried everything they could to stop those ships from unloading, but they were unsuccessful. And at that point, it was decided to evacuate the civilians. So about 1,000 people left Gibraltar, and there were 1,000 fewer mouths to feed. Now we're coming up on the third winter, November of that winter. The garrison is hungry again, right? This has happened three winters in a row. They receive word from Spanish deserters, and this surprises me because I wonder who these deserters were. Right? Prisoners, I can understand, but deserters? In any case, they receive word from Spanish deserters that the Spanish are planning a major assault. And in order to impede that, in order to preempt that, to go first, to be proactive, they decide something absolutely desperate, which is a sortie, that's the French word, salida. It means sortie is a military term in English. And that means abandoning a defense position in order to make an attack outside the walls. Now, you've got about 3,000 soldiers and 99 officers. So, we're talking about a good percentage. There was practically nobody left in Gibraltar itself. Everybody who could go on this sortie did. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, they went straight to the enemy lines, and it was completely unexpected. And so, yes, they began the systematic destruction of those lines. There was heavy fighting, obviously, but it was largely successful. The British destroyed the provisions, the ammunition, the defensive structures, and everything they could, everything of use, was taken back into Gibraltar itself. So about 14 months of preparation was undone in one night. And the British troops had seriously destroyed or ruined the Spanish ability to attack. When they left, they set fire, and that fire reached the magazine, where the gunpowder was kept, and there were enormous explosions which simply destroyed the rest of the Spanish lines. Now, at this point, there's a game changer. At this point, things begin to happen that it gets more serious, because at this point, Menorca had been retaken. And so the French and Spanish, who were responsible for retaking Menorca, were now free to be used in Gibraltar. Sotomayor was relieved. Sotomayor was taken away, maybe in disgrace, but in any case, it was now a French operation. The Duc de Crillon, or rather, Bertrand de Crillon, he was the Duc de Mahon, because he had been responsible for the taking of Mahon, right? And with him, by the way, Don Luis de Cordova had been under the orders of Crillon, escorting Crillon at this point. And so Luis de Cordova is going to be taking over. And with him comes Buenaventura Moreno. Buenaventura Moreno has an idea about like a floating battery, not a warship, but a kind of a floating fortress that can be used to attack Gibraltar. There will be a series of floating fortresses. I'm surprised that nobody had thought of this before, but it sounded like a really, really good idea. And so Buenaventura Moreno and Luis de Cordova are now pretty much inside. After Menorca, by the way, Menorca is the Insula Minor, right? That's what it was called in Latin. And because it was minor in Latin, quite often in English you will find it written as Minorca and not Menorca. And yes, the English had taken possession after the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713. And they had been there since, for most of the century, right? They'd been there for, 70 years. In 1782, the French and Spanish combined retook the island, and that freed up, liberated a lot of resources for the siege of Gibraltar. The new Spanish battery was called the Mahon, and it was built very quickly. Meanwhile, in France, the American War of Independence is over. And so you've got the people responsible for signing the Peace of Paris. You've got them waiting to sign. Right? All eyes are on Gibraltar. What is going to happen in Gibraltar? Right? The British are not prepared to recognize American independence and a state of non-belligerence, right? A non-offensive state until this whole business about Gibraltar is clarified. Meanwhile, trying to bring Gibraltar down, you've got some Americans working there. You've got one of Crillon's aides, a man named Little John, an American, there as a representative of the Allies, right? Spain and France had been, as I say, integral in the creation of the United States. And so the United States was, in a small way, there with them at Gibraltar. This was the time in Gibraltar when the whole mountain started to be ahuecado, right? Hollowed out. So yes, the Peña, the rock of Gibraltar, is like a Swiss cheese, all filled with tunnels, and many of these tunnels were dug at this time. They had years and years to dig these tunnels, and and so you had guns, you had cannons placed in these tunnels, and of course, being elevated, they were able to strike at longer distances, but evidently there was a lot of problems with shooting downward. And these cannons were not designed to shoot downwards, and the ballistics, the calculations for shooting downward didn't exist. All of that had to be invented or improvised at this time. And another improvisation, another tactic that was going to be enormously effective was the shooting of, now I've forgotten the Spanish name, perdigas, grape shot, right? Little tiny balls, metal balls, like bullets, but many of them at the same time and smaller. What you do is you put them in an oven and you heat them until they are red hot. Now, I imagine this is something the Romans might have done, but since then, I think it had not been done. They found a way to do it. They found a way to shoot this. And by the conventions of the time, this was considered enormously cruel, because you can imagine what happened to human beings when they were hit with this. But at the same time, it was enormously effective in terms of causing fires and These were called hot potatoes. At the time, hot potatoes. And they were enormously enormously effective. After a couple of hours of bombardment with these hot potatoes, the entire Maon battery and works, all of the defensive works, all of the joint Spanish-French line of attack was on fire. In English, we talk about thinking outside of the box. In other words, you have to be unconventional, right? If the same formula always gives you the same conclusion, and that conclusion is ineffective, then it is necessary to be creative, to think outside the box, to idear, to come up with something brand new. And the idea was now a series of floating batteries in a great assault. Now, these batteries had thick wooden armor with layers of wet sand. In other words, they were considered to be inflammable, that it would be impossible to burn. In addition to which, they were covered with cables and other things to soften, right, to amortiguar, to buffer the impact of anything that the British shot. And the great assault took place under the command of Don Buenaventura Moreno on the 13th of September, 1782. The 30,000 sailors and Marines, 30,000. We're talking about the 18th century when there weren't as many people around as there are today. 30,000 people. In our times, what would that be? 150,000? In any case, 30,000 sailors and Marines under the command of Don Luis de Córdoba and these new floating platforms with about 200 heavy guns under Buenaventura Moreno. They were supported by 86 land guns, 35,000 Spanish, and 8,000 French troops. And this was the assault. Now, you had 80,000 spectators. So yes, this was going to be a battle, and this was also going to be entertainment. So you can imagine people coming from everywhere. I wonder what the population of Cádiz was at the time, because 80,000 people on the looking at what is going to happen next, right? Fully expecting that this assault would be definitive. But things began to go wrong. You had the weapon, you had the new floating platforms, you know, almost like a floating fortress. They were sent out into the water, but badly deployed, so that they weren't in the right position. They weren't in the position of most efficacy. And ran aground, some of them became immobilized. It just wasn't working. Then, the Spanish army ran out of gunpowder, right? There was no more pólvora. Bad planning. A lack of logistics. It was only temporary, but they were not able to give cover when they were supposed to. Now, Luis de Córdoba, the admiral in charge, did nothing at this point. He stayed out and did not intervene, didn't come in. He could have made a difference at this point, but his inaction, you can imagine how frustrating it was for everybody involved to see this. It was a fiasco. All right. On that note, I really apologize, but I have run out of time. I will have to continue this on my next program.
Escuchando Vaughan Radio.
Nuestro curso online es único por una sencilla razón. Nuestros profesores son los mejores del mercado. Richard Vaughan, Ximena Holiday, Kyle Miller, Alberto Alonso, Richard Brown, nuestros All Stars desde cualquier lugar. Por menos de 30 céntimos al día. Quédate en casa y aprovecha para poner en forma tu inglés. Entra en la web cursodeinglesonlinevaughan.com e infórmate. Pruébalo durante 2 semanas y si no te gusta, te devolvemos el dinero. cursodeinglesonlinevaughan.com, porque hay muchos, pero solo uno de Vaughan.
¿Quieres recibir clase conmigo? Pues si quieres, tienes 200 horas de clase de inglés gratis en RTV.